It's summer 2006. An unremarkable day. Bridget McLaughlin's car is stalled near the Glenageary roundabout in South Dublin. She's listening to a cookery programme on BBC Radio 4. Then she sees it. The silver van. She sees the man behind the wheel. The man she calls the Savage. He's staring at her, a half smile on his face, a Starbucks coffee in his hand, his tongue pushed into his left cheek. It's a habit he has. Bridget looks directly into his eyes, her body stiffening. She's frozen. The car won't budge. Motorists beep their horns behind her. Why? Why is he here? Going about his business, free as a bird. He stares at her a moment longer, wearing that sinister smirk. The lights turn green and he speeds away. The Savage. When someone is murdered in Ireland, the Gardaí call in a team of forensic scenes of crime examiners from the Technical Bureau. For 25 years, I was a part of that team. My name is John Sweetman. I was there to help read the silent and often hidden clues at a crime scene. I saw what killers tried to hide. Fingerprints unknowingly left behind. Murder weapons hidden in plain sight. Handwriting that betrayed a lie. Every detail told the real story, and now I'll tell you those stories. In this podcast from Go Loud, I take you inside some of Ireland's most haunting crimes. This is Lines of Inquiry, a Go Loud original podcast that looks beyond the headlines, following the evidence step by step and uncovering the stories behind the investigations. In this episode, a cold-blooded and heartless killing in the affluent South Dublin suburb of Goatstown. A calculated act of violence brought about by greed and a thirst for control. This is Lines of Inquiry. The Savage. The murder of Siobhan McLaughlin. Ireland in 2006 was still in the clutches of the Celtic Tiger boom. Ireland's economic miracle, which stretched from the mid-1990s to 2008. It was a period of plenty, huge economic growth fueled by foreign direct investments. It transformed the country, it transformed how people lived. Pro-business, regulatory policies and low corporation tax proved to be great incentives for multinational companies, coupled with a younger, tech-savvy workforce meant that the Irish people enjoyed a higher disposable income, which led to more consumer spending. The new wealth resulted in large investments in modernising Irish infrastructure and cities. The National Development Plan meant better roads and new transport services, such as the Luas and the Dublin Port Tunnel. The building boom was still in full swing, and it would be another 2 years before the property bubble burst, and Ireland was plunged into a recession in 2008. But in early 2006, there was no reason to fear that the good times were coming to an end. In the Knocknashee area, in the affluent suburb of Goatstown in South Dublin, the evidence of the boom was on display. Cairn Row was a two-story detached house at the end of its row. It was home to 38-year-old Siobhan McLaughlin and her husband, 49-year-old Brian Kearney, and their 3-year-old son, Dan. The couple had built another house next to theirs as an investment. They were a successful professional couple. Siobhan was a fully qualified chef, and Brian ran his own electrical contractor business. Along with the two houses in Dublin, they also had property abroad, having bought and renovated a 200-year-old three-story house in the town of Solier in Mallorca in 2002. They converted the building into a 6-bedroom boutique hotel called The Salvia, which they opened in 2003. It was open to guests between April and October, so the couple would split their time between the sunny Balearic Island and Ireland. Siobhan McLaughlin was the fifth eldest in a family of seven girls and one boy. Her father, Owen, had roots in northwest Donegal, and her mother, Deirdre, was born in Waterford City but grew up in Howth. The McLaughlin children grew up in the Ward, County Dublin, which lies between Finglas and Ashburn. Owen ran a farm machinery dealership, and Siobhan and her siblings spent their summers wandering the wheat fields that surrounded their bungalow, wearing black Wellingtons, t-shirts and shorts. They'd fish for minnows in the Broadmeadow River which ran behind their house, and help the local farmers with the haycocks, as well as picking strawberries, potatoes, mushrooms, tomatoes and peas. When they'd arrive home thirsty, Deirdre would make them lemonade and apple tarts. It was an idyllic time, a childhood full of simple joys of rural life, and a life free from fear. Siobhan's family would call her Shawnee. She was obsessed with cooking and baking from a young age. In her book, Tales of a Patchwork Life, Siobhan's sister, Bridget, remembers Siobhan having two huge almond-shaped blue eyes. She looked like the actress Tippi Hedren from Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. She was delicate, beautiful. When she was 5 years old, Siobhan was diagnosed with purpura, a condition that causes bruise-like spots to break out all over the body and inside the membranes of the mouth. It can also be an early sign of leukemia. She had to stay in Dublin's Temple Street Hospital for several weeks and lost a lot of weight. She remained thin for the rest of her life. At 16, Siobhan left school and got her first job in the Granary Restaurant in Temple Bar. She was a natural in the restaurant business. From there, she travelled to Jersey to train as a commis chef, working as a junior chef assisting senior chefs and learning the fundamentals of professional kitchen operations. She learned it all, every fine detail of the etiquette and high level of service expected by guests and clients. On her return to Dublin, Siobhan was accepted into Cahill Brewer Street to study culinary arts. When she was awarded with her diploma, she was offered a commis chef position in Dublin's illustrious Shelburne Hotel. It was hard work, but it was her passion. She loved being surrounded by the tastes and sizzling sounds of the sophisticated food being prepared. She would go on to work as a chef in several more places, before eventually setting up her own business. It was called Crown Connoisseurs, and it catered for upmarket private clients. In 1989, she went to work as a chef in an electrical factory, Yamaguchi Electrical, in the West Dublin area of Mulhuddart. It was there that Siobhan met Brian Kearney, the man who would become her husband. Brian was 10 years older than her and had a daughter from a previous relationship. He worked as an electrician at Yamaguchi and would go on to have his own electrical contracting business. Brian had pursued Siobhan, asking her to go on a date many times before she finally said yes. He would later say he didn't realize she was so much younger than he was. Her personality made her seem older, more mature. On the morning of the 28th of February, 2006, Brian Kearney's 49th birthday, Siobhan's sister Niamh parked her car outside the house in Knocknashee at around 9:35 a.m. She did this every weekday to avoid traffic jams while going to work in Ernst & Young in the city centre, where she was employed as a receptionist. Siobhan had given her a key to the house, so Niamh let herself in. Inside, she found 3-year-old Dan wandering around the house, seemingly on his own. He was crying. There was no sign of Siobhan. When he saw Niamh, the toddler said, "Mammy gone." Niamh searched downstairs for her sister, but there was no sign. She then went upstairs. Siobhan's bedroom door was locked. She knocked on the door but got no reply. Then she looked through the keyhole. There was no key in it. Niamh was uneasy. Siobhan would never lock her room. Siobhan would never leave Dan alone in the house. Niamh phoned her parents, Owen and Deirdre, and her sister Aisling. Her mum and dad arrived at around 10:20 a.m. and Owen, who was in his early 70s, managed to kick in Siobhan's bedroom door. Siobhan's bed was empty. Owen was relieved to see that. There were some family photographs scattered on it, but it was empty. Then he turned to scan the rest of the room. Any relief or hope faded in an instant. There he saw his daughter Siobhan, lying on her back on the floor, near the door to the ensuite bathroom. She was wearing her red tartan pajamas and a white top. Something was underneath her, coiled. It looked like an electrical flex or cord. There was a cut on her chin. Her face was crimson, and there was a red mark around her neck. Owen touched his daughter's leg. She was cold. Just then, Siobhan's mother, Deirdre, came to the bedroom door. Owen warned her, "Don't come in, Deirdre. She's dead." But it was too late. Deirdre had seen Siobhan's leg. She screamed. She fell to her knees. She crawled back down the stairs, howling, hysterical. She cried out, "She's dead. Siobhan is dead. Siobhan is dead." 3-year-old Dan was staring up at his grandmother, his eyes full of tears. Despite their pain and horror, the family made arrangements and got Dan out of the house as quickly as they could. Paramedics from the Dublin Fire Brigade Service soon arrived at the house. John Fitzgerald, an emergency medical technician, noted that Siobhan's body was showing signs of rigor mortis, so there was no attempt made to resuscitate her. His colleague, Mark Dempsey, saw the electrical cable that Owen had seen. Dempsey could see it was wrapped around Siobhan's chest. One end of it appeared to have been cut. There was a Dyson vacuum cleaner nearby, and there were marks on Siobhan's neck. Another member of the emergency services, Station Officer Michael O'Reilly, told the others not to touch anything, and he then called the Gardaí. By the time two more of Siobhan's sisters, Aisling and Bridget, arrived at Knocknashee, Brian Kearney had returned home. He was in the living room with his sister. He appeared to be having palpitations. He stood up and approached Bridget. "Oh, poor you," he said. "And after all that happened to you with poor Michael dying." He was referring to Bridget's husband, Michael, who had tragically drowned 3 years before in 2003. Kearney then turned to Niamh. He told her that he and Siobhan were going to be together forever. Kearney hadn't asked Siobhan's mother what was wrong when she phoned him, telling him to get home right away. Now, he didn't appear to be showing any emotion. Siobhan's sisters noted that his face was blank. He hadn't even asked about his son, Dan. When the Gardaí arrived at Cairn Row, Detective Inspector Martin Cummins was told that he was dealing with a possible suicide. He had requested a Garda photographer to attend the scene, to assist any future inquest. Bridget tipped him on the shoulder. "I need to speak to you," she said. Cummins replied that he was busy. Bridget was persistent. "But I need to speak to you now." But at that moment, the DI was still taking in the scene and couldn't give Bridget his full attention. So, she approached one of the other Gardaí present, Sergeant Charlie McConlogue, who also happened to be a friend of the McLaughlins and had known Siobhan for 30 years. He had formally identified her body and was now consoling Siobhan's parents. Bridget took him aside and spoke to him. Following this, McConlogue approached Cummins. "Treat this as a murder investigation," said McConlogue. Cummins raised his eyebrows. "Why do you say that?" "Just do," said Charlie. "I know." When Bridget McLaughlin had spoken to Sergeant Charlie McConlogue, and he in turn assured Detective Inspector Cummins that they might not be dealing with a suicide, it didn't take long for the wheels of a murder investigation to begin turning. The investigating Gardaí soon began to see a scene that was far more suspicious than the initial suspected suicide. They made the rare step of ordering a news media blackout, barring any reports on the specific details of the incident, for 48 hours. This was done to allow them critical time to gather forensic evidence from the home. They were acutely aware of previous crimes where early media reports on details of the crime scene had almost ruined chances of guilty convictions later. They decided to take no chances. A team from the Garda Technical Bureau arrived to begin a forensic examination of the scene. Family members were asked to leave, and as Bridget walked through the kitchen on her way out, she saw homemade scones on the countertop. Siobhan's last cooking. A calendar showed a handwritten note under the day's date, 28th of February. It read, "Daddy's birthday." The McLaughlins went to the nearby Goat Inn and waited there all day until they were finally contacted at 7 p.m. and told that Siobhan's body was being removed from the house at Knocknashee. Bridget, in her book Tales of a Patchwork Life, wrote about the terribly sad scene. "Holding on to each other, we watched in numbed silence as the ambulance men carried down a brown metal box from Shawnee's bedroom. I remember the box. It wasn't a coffin. It was a box, like a toolbox, a large 6-foot toolbox. The brown paint was peeling off it. Shawnee was inside. No dignity. We all stood over her and said the rosary through a long succession of sniffs and sobs. Shock, shock, shock. Our beautiful, elegant Shawnee was inside this box. Dead. She was lying in a strange box that held hundreds of dead people before her. A box worn from deadness and death. A box that was now full of questions. Full of misery and mystery. That brown box going into an ambulance with a siren blazing, even though there was no emergency." Brian Kearney spoke to the Gardaí at the house. He told Detective Inspector Martin Cummins that he and Siobhan had been sleeping in separate bedrooms for some time. He said that before he left for work on the morning of the 28th of February, he had tried the door to Siobhan's room, but it had been locked. He had knocked on the door, saying, "I'm off. Dan's downstairs." The key to the room was later found inside, on the floor, near the door. Later that night, Gardaí went to Brian Kearney's parents' house to collect the clothes he had been wearing that day. Kearney's mother told them that she'd already washed the clothes, as they had been sweaty. Numerous items were taken as evidence from Siobhan's bedroom, including the length of electric cable that had been found on her body. Professor Mary Cassidy had carried out the post-mortem and deduced that Siobhan had died from asphyxiation due to neck compression, consistent with either low-level hanging or manual strangulation. The pathologist noted a clear tide mark running around Siobhan's neck, with the skin above the line left by the cable, which turned out to be the flex from the Dyson, showing marked lividity or a bluish-purple discoloration compared to the pale skin below the line. Detective Garda Jeanette O'Neill, a Technical Bureau member from the ballistics section, had examined the wardrobe in Siobhan's bedroom to see if the clothes racks could have been used in a supposed hanging, but she could find no evidence of any weight having been applied. However, Dr. Michael Norton, a forensic scientist from Forensic Science Ireland, examined the door to the ensuite and noted that a section of the paintwork on the top edge of the door, the edge facing the bedroom, showed a small shallow groove with purple material lodged in it. This material was the same colour as the covering of the flex. Detective Garda Chris O'Connor examined the scene for fingerprints, but found none on the electrical cable around Siobhan's body. As Gardaí searched the house, they opened up the hot press. There, in behind the water tank, they found an A4-sized diary. It was Siobhan's. They found her passport, too, hidden in a sheet in the hot press. In the bottom drawer of her dresser, they discovered a 500 euro note concealed in wrapping paper. The picture was incomplete, and it raised questions for the Gardaí, who were attempting to reconstruct whatever terrible events that had occurred inside that suburban bedroom. Had Siobhan suspended herself over the ensuite door and the cable later snapped? Was there any evidence that she was actually suicidal? In one of her last communications with anyone, an email sent to her brother's partner in Italy, Siobhan had written, "Say a prayer for me." But this appears to have been written in the context of the rest of the message, in which she spoke about her wild, wild, wild son, saying, "I just can't keep up with him. He's football mad. I've lost 3 pounds in the last week." It seemed like a typical parent raising a young boy, not a cry for help. Siobhan had been admitted to St. John of God's Hospital some years earlier in 1999, but it was from stress and overwork. She stayed there for just a few days. Her sister Bridget reckoned that the stress was as a result of living with Brian Kearney. Siobhan's family had never taken to her husband. Her mother, Deirdre, wouldn't shake his hand the first time they met. She felt there was something off, something not quite right. Siobhan's sister Bridget felt Brian was a man impossible to read. He was someone who seemed to refuse to let anyone in, someone who thought primarily about himself and his own issues. Brian would watch, apart from whatever else was going on, never involved, never interested. He was only interested in particular material things: money, food, and boats. Bridget couldn't understand it. She quizzed Siobhan about why she was seeing him. Siobhan's reply was more rooted in hardened reality than romance. She told Bridget that Brian might be neither good-looking nor exciting, but was reliable, hard-working, and trustworthy. "Biddy girl," Siobhan would say, "I know he's boring, but he's safe." Siobhan and Brian got engaged in 1995, but they split up just a few months later, before reuniting a few years afterwards. Not long after they got back together, Siobhan suffered a miscarriage. The couple were married in January 2002, and soon after Siobhan moved into Carn Row, the house Brian bought in Goatstown, South Dublin. Dan was born in July that year. Their €2.2 million purchase of the Hotel Salvia in Mallorca would follow, and both Siobhan's and Brian's businesses would flourish. They split their time between Mallorca and Ireland, as the hotel was only open during the summer months. In early 2006, they were back home living in Goatstown. Bridget, and indeed most of the McLaughlin family, did not like Brian Kearney. Bridget had her own nickname for him: the Savage. She recalls of him that if he had a plate of food in front of him, he would put his arms around the plate. His head went down, as if to possess it. He made a lot of noise when he ate. He slurped down his food, slobbering, chewing, lip-smacking like a badly trained dog. His social graces and social engagement were non-existent. Christmas 2003 would be the first Siobhan would spend at the newly acquired Hotel Salvia in Mallorca. She invited Bridget, her husband Michael, and Michael's daughter Jane to stay. It would also be Bridget's first time seeing the hotel. Siobhan collected them from the airport and drove them to the sleepy Solier Valley on the other side of the island. They drove down narrow cobbled streets, through leafy plazas and past quaint little cafes. Bridget noticed a sign that read "Cemetery Solier." She didn't like that the hotel was on the same street that led to the cemetery. They turned off into a narrow back street, this one called Calle de Muragues. Bridget thought that it meant Street of the Dead, but Siobhan assured her that Muragues was the name of a local family that produced olive oil. When they got to the hotel, they entered through a side door. Inside, it was beautiful, all cobblestone floors and a huge vase of pale roses atop an enormous mahogany table. While Siobhan was excited to be showing the place off, Bridget thought her sister looked stressed. Then Siobhan showed Bridget the kitchen. It was all stainless steel and chrome. It had been previously run by a Michelin star chef. Bridget's husband, Michael, was eager to start giving out Christmas presents, and as he was dishing out bottles of wine, perfume and sticky toffee puddings, they heard footsteps approaching. It was Brian Kearney, the savage. "You got here," he said, sounding jaded and disinterested. The atmosphere had changed. Bridget feigned a smile, while Siobhan pressed her lips together tightly and appeared to clench her teeth. Christmas passed relatively uneventfully, but then came New Year's Eve. Bridget and Michael had booked dinner in a 16th century restaurant in the Residencia Hotel in Deia as a surprise for Siobhan and Brian. It was high up in the mountains near Solier. The 500-year-old candlelit restaurant specialised in authentic Majorcan food. Michael's daughter Jane, who has Down syndrome, was in her element, eating crispy duck and drinking mocktails. But Brian munched, crunched and drooled his way through his food, before finally pushing back from the table, wiping his mouth and asking, "I presume you are paying the bill, Biddy." Naturally, as the meal had been a surprise gift, Bridget and Michael fully intended to cover the bill, but Siobhan was furious over her husband's remark. Brian tried to pass it off as a joke, but it wasn't. Michael told him that the bill had already been settled. Siobhan then turned to her husband. "Put that in your pipe and smoke it." Bridget could see that her sister's comment had left Kearney seething, and the atmosphere remained tense until they arrived back to the Hotel Salvia. On their return, Siobhan and Brian disappeared into the kitchen. Bridget crept closer and could hear them arguing inside. "That bitch sister of yours," she heard Brian say. "I want her gone." He also could be heard sternly telling his wife that he was the boss. When Siobhan came out of the kitchen, she grabbed Bridget's arm and they made their way back to the huge log fire where Michael and Jane were sitting. She said to her sister, "Biddy girl, I've got to leave him." Brian returned to Ireland once New Year's had passed, as did Michael and Jane, but Bridget was reluctant to leave Siobhan, so she stayed a while longer. One night, Brian phoned, clearly angry. He told Siobhan he wanted her sister out of the hotel, immediately. Bridget was wary of him returning at any moment, so she rented a little house nearby for the remainder of her stay. Bridget returned to the Hotel Salvia again that summer. But when she arrived, Siobhan was away in Palma, and Brian Kearney greeted her. "Why are you here?" he said. "You never seem to leave the place." He then said he was going to do some gardening, and proceeded to cut down a jasmine bush outside. He hacked at an orange tree, and cut down all the billowing purple and pink bougainvillea from the terrace until it was bare. He even demolished little Dan's wild strawberry tree. Single-handedly, he had wrecked the garden. He had destroyed Siobhan's corner of paradise, the one place she found peace. When Siobhan returned to find her garden torn apart, she was distraught. Tears streamed down her face. She told Bridget she couldn't take it anymore. She said if she didn't leave Brian, she feared she would have a heart attack. She told Bridget, "Mediterranean life is over for me. I want to go home to Mammy." It wasn't the first time Brian had showed complete disregard for his wife. When Siobhan contracted the shingles, he decided to go away with his friends. She begged him to stay. Because shingles is highly contagious, she couldn't be around the hotel's guests. She pleaded with him. "I'm worn out, Brian. I can't work any harder. I'm on my own here. You are never here. This was meant to be our project." He left anyway, To Siobhan, it was an inescapable fact that Brian was an absentee husband who had no interest in her or their son. Towards the end of 2005, Siobhan asked Bridget to come with her to Italy to visit their brother, Owen John. Bridget was reluctant because Brian would also be there. Siobhan assured her that everything would be okay. She promised that she would set her divorce plans in motion when she got back to Ireland. So Bridget went. On the day she was due to fly home, she and Siobhan went to the hotel sauna. Brian was taking Dan to the pool. Siobhan reminded Brian to make sure Dan kept his armbands on and stayed away from the deep end. She warned her husband not to take his eyes off their son. But afterwards, when the sisters went to meet Brian and Dan in the restaurant for lunch, Dan ran over into Siobhan's arms, still in his wet togs. "Mama," he said, "I fell into the pool and a man came to take me out." Siobhan asked, "Did Daddy not take you out?" Dan said, "No, it was another man." Siobhan turned to Brian, obviously upset. She asked what had happened. Brian flatly replied that Dan had gone under the water in the deep end of the pool. Siobhan asked him, did he not go to help him? Brian told her that he let Dan struggle. He had to learn. Siobhan was horrified. A short time later, Siobhan, Bridget and a freshly bathed and dressed Dan met up with Owen John. He was shocked to hear what had happened at the pool. Bridget said she thought Brian was jealous of his own son. Siobhan agreed. She remembered that when Dan was born, Brian had showed no emotion. Siobhan was, by then, actively pursuing a separation from her husband. The dream of owning and running the Hotel Selvia in Mallorca had soured. She worried that she wasn't spending enough time with Dan, but felt that Brian was pressuring her to continue running the hotel. They put the hotel up for sale and she moved back to live in Goatstown. Siobhan was exploring the logistics of splitting from Brian and possibly moving with Dan into the house that had been built adjoining the family home. She had engaged a family law solicitor to act for her. She told him of her position, but letters sent by the solicitor to Brian seeking a trial separation were left unanswered. She had stopped wearing her wedding ring. On a windswept night in February 2006, Siobhan arrived at Bridget's cottage in Dalkey. She came in the door with her corn-coloured hair tossed from the wind. She carried with her a set of Madeleine cake trays. Bridget had been trying to find one for ages. Siobhan had tracked them down in a little shop off Grattan Street. The sisters would talk about a lot of things that night, but before they did, Siobhan had to get one thing out of the way. She had to call Brian, because she was to collect Dan from him first thing in the morning. She knew she wouldn't be able to relax until she had done it. She told Bridget that even the sound of Brian's voice made her sick. When Siobhan was on the phone, Bridget saw her whole demeanour change. She looked afraid. She looked stressed. When she put down the phone, Siobhan could finally relax. They opened a bottle of wine and sat down in front of the turf fire to chat. Bridget wanted to ask Siobhan about the state of her marriage, but Siobhan looked tired, worn out. She decided she would talk to her in the morning. Later, Bridget brought her some sheets and a duvet for the sofa. She remembers, "I took the edges of the sheet under her like you would for a child, then bent over her and kissed her little forehead." Siobhan slept soundly. The next morning, while Siobhan still slept, Bridget made poached eggs and toast for breakfast and brewed a pot of tea. The sound of the cups clinking together woke Siobhan, who sat bolt upright. She asked what time it was and said she had to go. She hurriedly dressed, not even stopping for breakfast. Her only priority was Dan. She ran to her car. She told Bridget she would talk to her later. As she drove off, she shouted out the window, "I love you." It was the last time Bridget would see her alive. Following Siobhan McLaughlin's death, her family had to wait 9 days before her remains were released to them. During that time, Bridget was haunted by the fact that her sister lay somewhere in a cold freezer, in the dark. She couldn't bear it. The morning that Siobhan's body came home to her parents' house in Dalkey, Leslie Avenue was lined with people, coming to show their respects. The family had picked out a large American-style silver casket. They wanted only the best for their Shawnee. The house was packed for the wake. All of Siobhan's closest friends had come. But the casket was closed. The following morning, when the McLaughlins met at the funeral parlour, they could see that the funeral director, Frank Jennings, was nervous. His face was pale. He asked if anyone had a polo neck jumper or black scarf that they could place around Siobhan's neck. He wanted to hide her injuries before her family could say their final private goodbyes. One of Siobhan's closest friends went home to find something suitable. She returned with a delicate black shawl, sewn with small black flowers. It was beautiful, and it covered the dark blue ligature marks on her neck. Having seen Siobhan in the casket, Bridget rushed from the room. Outside, she saw Brian, the savage, waiting to go in with his friends. It was almost too much for her. The funeral mass was held on the 12th of March at the Church of the Assumption in Dalkey. It was standing room only. Hundreds of mourners attended. Brian Kearney sat separately away from the McLaughlins with his daughter Aoife. Father Ivan Tong spoke of the sudden and tragic death that Siobhan had suffered. Siobhan's brother and her six sisters read the prayers of the faithful. One of the sisters, Anne Marie, spoke of how Dan was the most important thing in Siobhan's life. They were inseparable, she said. She can rest in peace knowing that he will be close to us at all times. Dan wasn't at the mass, but Anne Marie told of how, a few weeks earlier, he had lost his favourite teddy bear, Nanu, while out shopping with Siobhan in the city centre. He was very upset, so Siobhan had driven back into town and spent hours calling to Garda stations to see if the toy had been handed in. Following the ceremony, Siobhan was laid to rest in Redford Cemetery in Greystones. Also present at the funeral were several of the detectives involved in the investigation into Siobhan's death. They each wore black ties as a mark of respect. By this time, they had their suspect, but not the proof they needed. Gardaí had by then detained and questioned Brian Kearney, but had released him without charge. One of the most interesting threads Gardaí sought to follow concerned the details of Brian Kearney's finances. Tony Massey, an accountant working for the Garda Bureau of Fraud Investigation, was able to determine that, as a successful electrical contractor, Kearney had a yearly income of around €120,000 a year, or €10,000 a month. Siobhan was also bringing in a substantial salary, but the acquisition and running of the Hotel Salvia was a considerable financial drain on the couple. The banks had advised Siobhan and Brian that they had overborrowed. While Kearney was asset rich, with businesses and property interests worth €4.6 million after tax, if he and Siobhan separated, he was looking at monthly payments of more than €15,000 between the hotel in Spain and the second house that they had built next to their own. The house that they were currently living in, Cairn Row, had also been remortgaged to help build this, as well as helping to pay for the hotel. If he and Siobhan split up, Kearney would have to sell the family home or the new house to cover the repayments on the €850,000 loan. In the days before her death, Siobhan had sought advice about legal separation in her local Citizens Information Centre, but Brian didn't want her and Dan moving into the new house. He wanted to rent it out. Several months after Siobhan's funeral, on June 28, Brian Kearney was arrested for a second time and questioned by Gardaí for 8 hours, before he was again released without charge. It was around this time that Bridget found herself sitting at traffic lights near the Glenageary roundabout in South Dublin. As she sat there listening to the radio, she noticed a silver van. It was him, the savage. He stared at her, coffee cup in hand, with a smile on his face. His tongue pushed into his left cheek. It was a particular habit that he had. It had been 6 months since Siobhan had died, and Bridget believed in her heart that Brian Kearney had murdered her. Kearney eyed her once more before speeding off. Bridget froze. Her car had stalled. The motorists behind her honked their horns impatiently before she could eventually restart her car. It wouldn't be the last time that she'd encounter him. Sometimes on the road, sometimes passing his shop in Dunleary. Throughout the rest of 2006 and into 2007, the Gardaí investigating Siobhan's death continued to gather evidence. They needed more. Enough to get across the line. Enough to satisfy the DPP to pursue a murder charge against Brian Kearney. To the McLaughlins, things were moving at a glacial pace. On the 12th of December, a candlelit vigil was held outside the house in Goatstown. Over 100 people attended. On the first anniversary of Siobhan's death, 28th of February 2007, the family appealed to the public for any information that could be helpful. A special mass was held in the Church of the Assumption in Dalkey. In April, Siobhan's mother, Deirdre, spoke about the unbearable grief that she was suffering. She said, "The pain is so deep. It is deep in my heart. It is gnawing at my bones." Then, at last, the McLaughlins got the news they had been waiting for. On Wednesday, the 30th of May, 2007, Brian Kearney was arrested at the new house he had built next to the home he had once shared with Siobhan, and the house where she had died. Kearney was brought before Dunleary District Court to face the charge of having murdered his wife. He pleaded not guilty. He showed no emotion and didn't look at the members of the McLaughlin family that were present. 1 week later, he was granted bail. In February 2008, at the Central Criminal Court, Brian Kearney's murder trial began. Almost immediately, there was a delay. The court learned that one of the jurors had worked for a company that had installed the security alarm in the house where Siobhan was allegedly murdered. The jury was discharged, and another one had to be selected. With the trial finally underway, the court heard evidence from Siobhan's sister Niamh and from Siobhan's parents about the events of the morning of the 28th of February 2006. Then came the details relating to Kearney's finances. It was the prosecution's case that not only had the accused a motive and opportunity to kill his wife, but that murder was the one inescapable conclusion to draw. The motive was money. Kearney was overstretched by his borrowing and was under pressure from the banks. Hotel Salvia still hadn't sold. One of the two houses in Knocknashee would have to be sold, and Siobhan was seeking a separation. As Dominic McGinn, acting for the prosecution, put it, whatever plan Kearney had, the difficulty was, the separation wouldn't fit it. The possibility that Siobhan had taken her own life didn't stand up to scrutiny. If she had hung herself from the ensuite door, why was the cable, or flex, not around her neck? The paramedics hadn't removed it, nor had Siobhan's father or sisters. Why was the bedroom door key on the floor, only a foot or so from the door? If she had locked herself in, surely the force of the door being burst open would have sent the key flying, assuming it had been dislodged from the lock. And there was no suicide note. There was no sign of any forced entry. The house alarm had been deactivated at 7:37 a.m. and Kearney had turned up for work between 7:50 a.m. and 8 a.m. He would have known that Siobhan's sister Niamh would arrive at Cairn Row sometime around 9 a.m. There was little in the way of forensic evidence. Brian Kearney's DNA wasn't on the flex, nor were his fingerprints, which in itself wasn't unusual considering the narrow surface area. However, Dr. Neil Murphy, a mechanical engineer, had tested the flex and had found that it would only have supported Siobhan's weight, around 54 kilograms, for about 5 seconds before breaking. But the break on the flex found on her body was clean, with no signs of stretching. which would have been expected if Siobhan's body had been suspended for a longer period of time. Then there was the testimony from the pathologist, Mary Cassidy. While she conceded that the flex could have caused the ligature marks on Siobhan's neck, other details found during the post-mortem pointed to a more grim conclusion. Professor Cassidy spoke about the deep bruising to Siobhan's neck and three separate fractures to her Adam's apple. In her opinion, these findings were more usually a factor suggestive of manual strangulation, less common in ligature strangulation, and unusual in low-level suspension. It was the pathologist's hypothesis that Siobhan had been strangled, possibly on the bed, before the flex was put around her neck. Her body was then suspended by putting the flex over the ensuite door, and the assailant left, locking the door and sliding the key back under it. The trial was based largely on circumstantial evidence. There was no intruder, a fact not disputed by the defence. It was proposed by the prosecution that Siobhan was probably still in bed when Brian Kearney entered her room on the morning of his 49th birthday. Maybe she had still been asleep when he put his hands around her neck. At some point, he decided to use a ligature and loop the purple flex from the Dyson vacuum cleaner around her neck. Then he pulled her body over to the door of the ensuite and hung the flex over it, looping it around the handle on the other side. But after a very short period of time, the flex broke and Siobhan crumpled to the floor, where her father would later find her. Kearney then left, but before he did, it would later emerge, he poured a bowl of Cocoa Pops for his 3-year-old son, Dan, and left him alone in the house, having throttled and garrotted the child's mother. The jury retired to consider their verdict on the 4th of March. The following day, by a majority decision of 11-1, they found Brian Kearney guilty of murder. Mr. Justice Barry White handed down the mandatory life sentence. Siobhan McLaughlin's family were not allowed to give a victim impact statement in court. Bridget said that this only added to their pain. The family had needed Kearney to hear how they felt. It would be later that the government would unveil a scheme whereby the families of murder and manslaughter victims would be given a statutory right to make a victim impact statement before sentencing. Bridget later said, "We should have had the opportunity to respond, and we weren't given it. But I am so, so delighted for the people who will be given it. It is the right thing." When Brian Kearney was led from the court, handcuffed to a prison officer, Bridget stared at him for the last time. She later wrote in her book, "I stared at his hands, those monstrous, unforgiving hands that applied a flex from a vacuum cleaner to my darling Shawnee's neck and thrust her over the bathroom door to hang. Yet again, his tongue rolled in his cheek, as it always did when he'd been caught out. It was good riddance to 65 kilos of pure evil." Siobhan's son Dan would later recount to his Aunt Aisling that although he had only been 3 years old at the time, he did witness some elements of what his father did to his mother on that terrible morning in February of 2006. He had tried to look through the keyhole of Siobhan's bedroom and recalled hearing his mummy getting sick. Bridget is surrounded by memories of her sister. She keeps Siobhan's chef's hat, a toque hat, in a long cream-coloured box, carefully wrapped in crepe paper. When she closes her eyes, she can see her, wearing the hat, as well as her white apron, freshly starched. Several years later, on a June morning in 2020, Bridget was doing some decluttering in her cottage in Dalkey when her son, Johnny, asked her, "Mum, will I throw this out?" Her heart skipped a beat. It was a rusty old Madeleine cake tray, one from the set Siobhan had given her just 2 nights before she was murdered. Bridget had hidden it behind the bed nearly 15 years previously because she would get too upset every time she saw it. The McLaughlins visit Siobhan's grave in Redford Cemetery regularly. It's always well tended, with three rows of white hyacinths running down the gentle slope which looks out on the Irish Sea. Her parents, Owen and Deirdre, are now 92 and 85 respectively. Owen visits almost every day and keeps the spot looking perfect. His daughter Siobhan, forever aged 38, rests below, dressed in a Spanish ball gown made of hundreds of black chiffon petals. The polished granite headstone reads, Siobhan Therese McLaughlin, Shawnee, the brightest star in the sky. On the granite steps of Fitzpatrick's Hotel in Killiney, Bridget McLaughlin stands and watches as her mother Deirdre gets out of her car and walks towards her. She sees that Deirdre is wearing a beautiful navy wool coat. Siobhan's coat. She hasn't seen it in 10 years. They link arms and head inside to their private little spot beside the roaring fire in the main foyer. As they sit, Deirdre takes a little photo album from her handbag. There's photos of Siobhan, barefoot, water skiing in Terry Glass, County Tipperary. Photos of her cooking in Hotel Salvia, showing Dan how to use a pasta machine. Another shows her dancing on a stage, her leg kicked high into the air. And Siobhan, in muddy jodhpurs, sitting astride a huge black horse. Deirdre's eyes burn with the pain of grief, even now. Bridget asks her, what word do you think best describes Siobhan? Deirdre pauses for a moment. Winsome, she says. There was something winsome, fragile about her. Is that the right word? Bridget checks it on her phone. Winsome, an adjective. Attractive or appealing in a fresh, innocent way. Engaging, sweet, endearing, dear. That's her, says Deirdre. She was all those things. To date, Brian Kearney has applied for bail 4 times. Each bid for freedom has been denied. He has never shown any remorse for his crime. But someday, perhaps soon, he will be released. Speaking to Dublin Live in December 2020, Bridget McLaughlin shared her feelings about Kearney's parole hearings and the possibility of him getting out of prison. We have our own cell that we live in every night. Our cell is the absolute absence of Siobhan. That's our cell. We share an empty cell every night, and it's a prison that he made for us. We can't ever get parole on our feelings. There's no emotional parole for us. A day when we get out. Thank you for listening to this episode of Lines of Inquiry. We now have an email address, linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com, and we would love to hear from you, so get in touch. Whether you have a story you think we should cover, or just want to let us know how you felt about an episode, that email is linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com. Wherever you're listening, please leave a comment on this episode and let us know what you think of the podcast. We really appreciate those who've taken the time to give the podcast a review. We now have over 5,000 five-star ratings on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Thank you. The generous support helps us to tell these stories. If you haven't yet rated the podcast, I'd be grateful if you could give us a 5-star rating wherever you're listening, sharing it on your story on Instagram, or simply telling a friend that you're listening to the podcast. Make sure to like or follow the podcast in your podcast app, and hit the notifications button so you'll know every time a new episode is released. Lines of Inquiry is presented by me, John Sweetman. This episode was written by me, with script editing from Owen Brennan. The podcast is created by Darren Cleary. Our executive producer is Owen Brennan. Our producers are Siobhan Walsh and Aoife Plunkett. Sound editing and design by Neil Kavanagh, with additional editing support from Ed Smith. Social media, marketing, video and legal support comes from the Go Loud team. Source material for this episode came from Bridget McLaughlin's memoir, Tales of a Patchwork Life, and news reports from RTE, The Irish Times, The Irish Examiner and The Irish Independent. In the end, everything done in the dark comes to light.